Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Coming up today, the New York area measles outbreak, what you need to know to protect yourself and your kids, why Dalton Conley takes his kids to certain adult movies and sometimes lets them curse them out. His new book is called Parentology. And our latest edition of Advice Roulette today, in which you get to ask another caller for one piece of advice about anything, but then you have to be willing to give advice to the next person. But we start today with Bridgegate. One of the biggest losers so far in the Bridgegate scandal, though you may not know his name, is Bill Stepien. He was Chris Christie's campaign manager for the original election in 2009 and the re-election last year, and he was on his way to becoming state Republican Party chairman and a consultant to the Republican Governors Association until the Bridgegate email bombshells in January that revealed his involvement. And Christie basically dumped him. This week, more emails involving Stepien have come to light, and they shed new light on what someone as close to the governor as he is or was knew about the lane closures even as they were still going on. Our Christie administration correspondent, Matt Katz, is here. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Brian.
And remind everybody who is not following every dotted I and every cross T of this, what was revealed about Stepien in January? And then tell us what's new this week.
In January, the governor said he was getting rid of Stepien because in the first batch of emails that we received, he was making disparaging remarks about local officials. And this was not the manner in which he wanted somebody so close to him to behave. So the governor had picked Stepien as the head of the state Republican Party just a week before. He had called him the best political operative in America. And he was supposed to be the governor's point man at the Republican Governors Association. The governor is the head of the Governors Association, and Stepien would have likely been the campaign manager for a Christie presidential campaign. But he didn't like the tone of his emails, so he dumped him. And we didn't really at that point have much more linking Stepien to Bridgegate. But this past week, as part of a new court filing, we found more emails with Stepien's name on it. And what's interesting is that it appears that Stepien was kept in the loop from while the lanes were being closed back in September about what was happening. He didn't really ask any questions about it, but he was told this. We got a complaint from the mayor of Fort Lee. He's very upset. He thinks there's political retaliation, and he just writes back, thanks.
In other words, these are emails going back and forth between other principals in the Bridgegate operation, and they are forwarding these emails to campaign manager Bill Stepien.
That's right. That's right. And you know, I spoke to Bill Stepien's attorney yesterday, Kevin Marino, and he said, you know, of course they were forwarding to him. This was going on in the midst of a campaign. It was becoming a news story. Of course he would want to know about it. But, you know, Stepien and the governor spoke three times a day. So Stepien is aware that the Fort Lee mayor thinks there's political retaliation going on. He's aware that the Fort Lee mayor says life and death situations are occurring in Fort Lee because of these massive traffic jams.
Even while these traffic jams are still taking place. So
that's
did
correct.
You ask Mr. Stepien's attorney if he discussed this with the governor at that time?
We don't know if he discussed it with the governor at that time. The attorney was more trying to make the argument that there's nothing in these emails indicating that Stepien was involved in the planning or the cover-up of this situation.
Ah, so he wants to reduce his client's vulnerability to prosecution?
He wants to avoid his – he wants to keep his client from handing over his own correspondence. His Stepien is now in court to keep his correspondence private. And the Democratic legislators who are investigating this matter desperately want his emails, his texts, his calendars, because they want to know if there's a text saying, hey, Gov, those lanes are closed. We really got them, something like that.
But Stepien's position is basically, I knew about it, but I wasn't participating in it.
That's right. And by Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination, I have the constitutional right not to hand over correspondence and incriminate myself.
Listeners, a rare opportunity to ask Matt Katz himself questions. You see him all over network television these days as the WNYC and New Jersey public radio person who knows so much about this scandal that he is the go-to guy, like all over the country. So you can ask Matt Katz yourself any detail regarding Bridgegate as it continues to unfold this week. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So I want to come back to the governor, because one of the central questions regarding Mr. Christie is, did he lie in that long news conference in January, and he's reaffirmed it since, his claim that he did not know about the lane closures as they were taking place. And we previously had Mr. Wildstein, one of Christie's guys at the Port Authority, asserting without presenting any evidence that Christie did know while it was taking place. And now we have what you were just describing with respect to when Bill Stepien, who you say spoke to the governor three times a day, and who was being told directly that there was a political concern by the mayor of Fort Lee, and while the governor's reelection campaign was in full swing. So all of this, you know, starts to make us ask again, is it credible that the governor did not know that the lanes were being closed while the lanes were being closed, as he asserts?
That's right. And we haven't had a chance to ask the governor about this new evidence because it's been more than 2 months since he's had a press conference. And there were more emails released this week that also lead to more questions about what the governor knew. We now know that his communication staff was well aware of the lane closures, at least right after they happened. And we have emails of them actively ignoring reporters' questions. So that means they either, this wasn't a concern for them. They didn't think it was that big of a story and it would involve the port and they blew it off, or they were avoiding answering questions because they were covering something up. If they were avoiding answering reporters' questions and they were not covering something up, why weren't they trying to get answers? Or why weren't they running this up the chain to the governor to say, hey, listen, we keep getting reporter calls. There's like a crazy traffic jam and there's suspicion that there's some political revenge plot involved. Why weren't this increasing number of top Christie staffers letting the governor know about this while it happens?
Sandy in Short Hills, you're on WNYC with Matt Katz. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have a question?
Yes, I do. I have a question because from the beginning of this unfolding scandal, I was kind of surprised that there were two people who were chosen to be fired by the government, by the governor. And it was Bill Stepien and Bridget Kelly. Now, Bridget Kelly obviously had involvement. Bill Stepien, no one knew. But is it possible
she,
that those
she
two
wrote
people—
again, just continuing to background everybody, she wrote that infamous email, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Go ahead.
Right. So is it possible that those two people were fired in order to allow them to protect their documents using the Fifth Amendment?
That's a interesting theory. I don't know if they knew that they'd be able to protect their documents. I mean, we're waiting now on a judge to decide whether that's legitimate. At the time, I didn't think it would have mattered. They were using government email and personal email, but about public business on government time. So it seemed to me that all their correspondence would be public whether they were fired or not. But that certainly is plausible. I mean, now we're really getting into the territory of maybe the bigger crime, if there was a crime committed, wasn't in closing the lanes, but in the cover-up, as we've seen in the past in American political history.
Hector in Union City, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Hector.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Good morning, I believe, Mark. My
Matt,
question is,
M-A-T-T, I mean, Matt Katz. Matt, how many different television networks have you been on now on this story, or are you losing count?
All I care about is WNYC, Brian.
We've trained him well, and he hasn't even been here that long. Hector, go ahead.
So my question is that they closed the bridge for a traffic study. Very well. Okay, so what is the outcome of the supposed traffic study? Because that's never come out.
That's because the traffic study, we think, does not exist at all. There were some maps and posters of the traffic scheme that were presented to the legislature in November as part of this cover-up story. But we have not seen any actual document, and now Port Authority officials say that the traffic study doesn't exist. That actually gets us back to Bill Stepien. When a Christie appointee, Bill Baroni, testified, we now know falsely, that these lane closures were due to a traffic study, Stepien sent Baroni a message the next day saying, "You did a great job," and he said, "I want to thank you." Now, this is interesting to me because at the time, Stepien was not actually employed by Team Christie. He was after he was the campaign. It was before he was taking his new job at the state party. So why is Stepien saying, "I want to thank you"? Now, there's two conclusions. One, he is acting on behalf of Team Christie. Stepien is going to be the campaign manager for the presidential campaign. This was a bad story. Baroni did a good job explaining their side of things. Or did Stepien know about it and Baroni, you know, was putting the cover out there for him and he wanted to thank him for covering things up? We don't know.
When you say the email said, "I want to thank you," this came out this week. Is this the same email that compared Baroni's testimony before the legislature to beating up on Frank Lautenberg?
That's right. Frank Lautenberg had held a congressional hearing last year over toll hike increases, and Baroni went down to Washington and flipped the table on Lautenberg and started reading him his free Easy Pass trips. And they got into this big kerfuffle, and the email that Stepien wrote to Baroni after his second testimony in Trenton about the lane closures was, "Hey, great job yesterday. I know it's not a fun topic and not nearly as fun as beating up on Frank Lautenberg, but you did great and I wanted to thank you."
And he said, at least you got the counter narrative out there, right?
That's actually what Baroni said.
Oh, Baroni said.
He said the Democrats may have the Democrats may have their nonsense, but at least we got the counter narrative out there. And that's interesting because Baroni at that point knows, we think, that the nonsense was actually the truth, which was the traffic study wasn't real. And the counter narrative was actually the lie. So it's hard to parse these things to understand, are they speaking entirely in code? Is one person in the dark and the other person understands the larger picture? Every bit of information that comes out lends to the larger story.
Because the word counter-narrative could mean another version of events, or it could be a euphemism for the cover-up.
Exactly.
So we can't exactly know that just from this document. Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if this question was asked before, but is there any video footage from the toll plaza to see who physically blocked the lanes and then maybe work backwards, like who told him and then who told him and so on?
There isn't, but at least that we haven't seen. I imagine there's the Port Authority keeps some video. What we do know is that the lanes were closed by the Port Authority police. And we know that the Port Authority Police Union was very close with the Christie administration. The Christie had helped had increased their force. And we know that the union, the head of the police union, was in contact with Christie's people. And the guy, the Christie appointee who ordered the lane closures, drove around the first day of the lane closures with a Port Authority police officer who happened to grow up with the Christie family in Livingston. So we do know that the lanes were closed by the cops, the Port Authority cops, and we do know that they were dealing directly with Christie appointees.
Thank you for your call, Dan. So, Matt, to step back for a minute and look at a bigger picture with respect to what this week's email revelation suggests about the governor. We now have a picture of a circle of people very close to the governor, knowing about the lane closures while they were taking place. Mr. Stepien, his campaign manager, Bridget Ann Kelly, Mr. Wildstein, and Mr. Sampson from the Port Authority, while the governor continues to assert that he himself did not know at that time. You were analyzing that before. It suggests to me at least a sophisticated campaign dirty tricks operation on Christie's behalf, that Christie is meticulously given plausible deniability about. Should the evidence at least lead us to that conclusion?
It could lead us to the conclusion that there might have been some sort of firewall between Christie and his people. So, you know, they were authorized to do what they needed to do, and he would never know about it. Now, was there authorization to do dirty things, or was there authorization to get as many, let's say, Democratic endorsements as possible, mm-hmm. which maybe may have led them to close the lanes on the Democratic Fort Lee mayor who didn't endorse him? We don't know. We know that these subpoenas are getting thousands and thousands of documents, and we've only seen a small portion of them. And actually, a little bit of news that hasn't been reported before that we can talk about this morning just confirmed that Christie's longtime secretary, her name is Rosemary Iannacone. She's been with him for 12 years since when he was a U.S. attorney. She quietly retired 2 weeks ago. And that's interesting only because she was subpoenaed. So we have another person who was close to him who's been subpoenaed who is now not working for him any longer.
What would the retirement indicate or suggest?
It might just suggest that she was 65 years old and she's very tough work being the scheduler and the gatekeeper for the governor, and she was the last person you would see when you went into the governor's office and the first person who would knock on the door to say, time to go on to your next appointment. So it may just mean she was ready to go off in the sunset. But it has a larger implication for the governor because he's lost a lot of people close to him in his inner circle in just the last few months. Bill Stepien, his main political guy, Rosemary Iannacone, his press secretary. His secretary. It's difficult for somebody who is looking to move on to the national stage to have a smaller and smaller number of people around him, particularly when he's so embattled like he is.
I want to mention that of our 10 lines, which are all full, four of the callers want to ask about Andrew Cuomo's potential role, or at least New York's responsibility, since the Port Authority is a bi-state agency. So let's take one of those calls. Nick in Queens. Hi, Nick. You're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. Good morning, Matt. Great reporting, by the way. It seems now that at least a half a dozen of Cuomo's appointees are not in compliance with residency requirements. One of them rushed to change his voting registration from Westchester to Manhattan. Now, Cuomo could be smiling in Albany watching Christie burn. But really, I mean, do you think that looking at all this, that the agency itself needs to be restructured? And if it does, can this ever be a voter referendum issue?
And what is this residency requirement? I haven't heard this before. Cuomo appointees to the Port Authority, you're saying?
All appointees, Brian, have to maintain residency within the five boroughs. And some of them have been maybe lax because they have dual residences in Westchester and Manhattan, in the case of this gentleman. But I believe there are others that aren't currently in compliance with that regulation.
Huh. Nick, thank you. Do you know that to be true? Forgive me, I don't know this detail. People who work for the Port Authority on the New York side they can't just live in New York State. They have to live in New York City. Do you know that to be true?
I did not know that.
We'll have to try to confirm that.
There's a Port Authority meeting today, so maybe we can try to get some answers on that. The relationship of Cuomo and Christie in this is super interesting. I mean, Cuomo has almost gone out of his way not to criticize or even really comment at all of this. And we know that they've spoken many times since this happened. Christie's talked about that. Also interesting that, Cuomo's running for re-election and Christie is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association and could, if he wanted, spend a lot of money in New York State trying to defeat Andrew Cuomo, or he could you know, keep hold on to the purse strings and decide not to not to go up against Cuomo in this year's election.
So before you go, as this all pertains to Governor Christie's potential presidential ambitions, which, let's face it, is why this is getting the big local, national, and international scrutiny that it is, because he was seen as a front runner, if not the front runner, for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Where it seems to me, as a matter of political analysis, that this really hurts Christie is that it's beginning to destroy his credibility as a crossover candidate. When we look at the polls in New Jersey, his Republican support is holding up pretty well. And even his independent support in a state with a lot of independents is holding up pretty well. But those many Democrats who said Christie was doing a pretty good job, which was part of the power that he was cultivating, because he had a lot of Democrats who were not inclined to like him or his style of politician or some of the things that he stands for, but they thought, hey, this is a straight shooter. This is a guy who says what he thinks and goes out and gets things done, and he's tackling hard problems. That support has started to fall off a cliff. And that's so relevant to the narrative of Christie's power as a potential presidential candidate that it seems to me that that's how it really, really hurts Christie going now toward 2016. And that could all change again, but I think that's where we are. Do you have any observation about that?
No, I think that's absolutely right on. I mean, his whole shtick about being post-partisan and beyond the sort of political fighting and nonsense is really called into question. Even if people do not believe he did anything criminal here or is involved in anything criminal here, they see that at least people who worked for him were involved and that it took a long time for him to kind of explain what was happening. And that is certainly going to hurt him amongst independent and Democratic voters.
And that they were playing very hardball against Democrats as he was giving Barack Obama a public hug and things like that that are more emblematic of what he was supposed to be creating as an image for himself.
That's right. I mean, he will potentially be able to fall back on the fact that when this first broke, he held a two-hour press conference and answered every question in the room. And even conservatives have started to say, well, Hillary didn't answer every question about Benghazi. She hasn't really answered one question about Benghazi. And he might be able to, if nothing hits him on this, and if there's no criminal charges, he may be able to say, listen, I found out what happened. I took decisive action. I got rid of four people, and I answered every question at a two-hour press conference. I am the straight shooter you always expected me to be.
Matt Katz covers the Christie administration for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. You can see more of his reporting and hear more of his reporting on our website, WNYC.org. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And leave it to Dalton Conley, NYU sociologist and author of books like The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why, to analyze his own parenting through the lens of the science and social science literature on child rearing. But wait, his new book, Parentology, does not read like an academic journal. In fact, it's more like an ironic confessional with a century's worth of data analysis craftily woven into stories about taking his children to adult movies. We'll hear how he defines adult and how he sometimes lets his kids curse at him. In fact, chapter 7 of the book is called Shut the F Up, Dad, Discipline or Lack Thereof. So rather than do a conventional book overview interview thing, let's talk about chapter 7. Hi, Dalton. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And by the way, Dalton Conley is chair of the Children and Youth section of the American Sociological Association. So we've posted an excerpt from Chapter 7 on our webpage, with your publisher's permission, encouragement even, that starts with the scene where your 11-year-old son calls you a goddamn pedophile. Want to tell that story?
Well, he was at that point, this is skipping forward or filling you in a bit, He was always had difficulty getting to sleep. We were dealing with ADHD issues, and we're trying various strategies with that. So it was very difficult to get him up in the morning all the time. It's a bit, literally, I had to drag him out of bed. I still do often, even though he's older. And so he was basically very grumpy at me and cursing at me while I was trying to put some peel some dirty socks off of him and, you know, get the process of getting dressed started. I accept that. I accept that he
So he blurted that out. And just to be clear, there was no whiff of any kind of alleged pedophilia. I just want our listeners who did not read the book, as I have, to be very clear on that. This is just a snarky quip because you're peeling dirty socks off him, which he's failing to do himself.
Right. It's just, you know, a low blow from him, so to speak. And, you know, if anything, I'd be proud that he knows what that word means at that age. So that's what the essence of this chapter deals with, the fact that I shifted my priorities from regulating their consumption of media and quote-unquote adult content and behavior in the home to basically turning everything into an educational opportunity as opposed to behavioral regulation.
So the point being, I think in part, that let your kids curse you out once in a while and otherwise be rude to you to a point, as long as they don't do it to others in public.
Right. I think there's an important distinction to make between public and private behavior. And in this day and age where those lines are increasingly blurred with Facebook and ask.fm and all sort and this new thing in the Times today about secret.com where people anonymously post snark, I think that going back to the old-fashioned notion of a clear boundary between what's private and intimate and where you can let your hair down back, what Irving Goffman, the sociologist, called backstage, and how you behave in the public sphere, i.e. the front stage, is an important distinction for kids to learn. And many parents emphasize their kids being obedient to them. And I worry, there's some research, but it's really inconclusive, but I worry that overemphasis on treating your parents with such respect and formality leads to release of pent-up frustration and other ill-advised behavior in the public sphere when the parents are not around. I'd much rather my kids be extremely polite in public to teachers, to other individuals on the subway and so forth, and let it all hang out at home than the other way around.
By the way, I've mentioned that there's an excerpt, this excerpt of the book on our page that's getting there. It's not there yet. So in a little while, you'll be able to read this for yourself at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, but not quite yet. The reason I made sure to mention that you're chair of the Children and Youth section of the American Sociological Association is so people just don't start calling up and call you Slacker Dad for this. You've already mentioned Goffman. You have a social science research-based underpinning for these paternal decisions?
Or rationalization or something. My colleague, Annette Leroux, the sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, distinguishes between two methods of child rearing that she observed in her ethnographic study. One is what's called natural growth, where kids are taught to obey parents. Their social life is largely separate from the adult world. They're taught to be quiet around adults, but then go off and play by themselves. And most instruction is in the form of commands or dicta to kids. And then the more middle class or highly educated parents tend to involve their kids in adult life more and tend to, instead of giving commands, tend to debate, as we know, give them choices and, you know, discuss why you have to take a bath now or get to school on time or what have you.
And then they either take the bath or they don't.
Right. You know, there's a whole literature on trying to structure the choices, make a false choice in a way. Do you want to take a bath or a shower?
But that's a trick.
Yeah. So, the idea is to engage. I think more important than the choice is the discussion about why it's necessary to take a bath.
Dalton Conley, author of Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, but We're Too Exhausted to Ask. Parents, anyone else? 212-433. WNYC. On this particular question, do you ever let your kids curse you out without consequences? And what about the bigger framework of styles of parenting that Dalton Conley is describing? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I will point out that one friend of mine, when I told him about this yesterday, knowing the segment was coming up, though this particular friend is childless, I should add, said, no way, wash their mouths out with soap. So have you gotten any reaction to that section? And does it vary by parent or non-parent status or sociologist versus non-sociologist?
The book just came out, so I haven't had a lot of feedback yet. I'm sure it's going to upset a lot of people. Even my own sister disagrees with my parenting approach. So I would explain, for example, what cannabis is to my kids and explain the chemical effects of THC and why it's not good for a developing brain to have THC in it and so forth. And she bans me from saying anything like that in front of her kids. So I see the differences in styles even within my own family.
And you do point out that it's only your son and not his sister, your daughter, who is inclined to even think about cursing anyone out. In fact, would you say that you have a little Bart and Lisa thing going on in your family?
Definitely. In fact, there's, I think, a betting pool at my daughter's school who can get her to curse the first, because she's never actually uttered a curse word. So it's interesting about how siblings want to differentiate themselves from each other. It's interesting how, you know, I didn't leave much space for her to rebel, and this is one way I guess she can rebel, by being super polite and goody two-shoes. That's fine with me. So, you know, and it makes you think maybe actually what we do makes no difference whatsoever, that it's all innate personality.
Being rebellious is, I mean, being a goody two-shoes is a form of rebellion. Did you just say that?
Possibly. You know, I describe another friend's daughter who is a very famous socialist. In fact, she ran on the socialist ticket for vice president, author of the famous anti-war play McBird. And her daughter, which way did she rebel? She became a religious conservative. So, you know, you got to go whichever direction there's room, I suppose.
Ed in Jamaica, Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, how you doing, Brian?
Good.
I got to disagree with your guest. I'm the father of a 16-year-old son, and I would never allow him to tell me F off or anything like that. I mean, it's an issue of respect. As my son developed, Brian, I discussed things with him differently as his comprehension increased and his ability to understand. We've discussed the ills of marijuana. I've also had a problem with substance abuse in my life. We've discussed the ills of certain behaviors as he got older. But it's an issue of respect. You know, you're not going to curse anybody out, especially me, because I am the provider, and you will have respect in my home.
I don't know if that has come up between you and your 16-year-old, but how would you enforce it?
It has come up, and I have enforced it.
How?
I've taken away privileges when he was younger, a little paddling on the butt. Now that he's older, I take away privileges. Mm-hmm. You won't be using the iPhone. You won't be using the computer.
Right.
I mean, you know, the punishment goes commensurate with the ability to understand.
Ed, thank you. Dalton, you want to say anything?
I think that calibrating punishment to level of understanding of the child by age is a great idea. I also want to say that I'm just throwing out my own experience and my own choices as an option, as something that other folks can, you know, adopt parts of, reject wholly, or just react to. So I think that there's no right way to parent, and we all have unique challenges. That's one of the arguments of the book, is that anybody who's trying to sell you a parenting book with, you know, the 7 bullet points is really selling you snake oil, that you really need to dive into each kid and each specific issue and understand what we know about those particular issues and try out different strategies and adjust as you're going along with trial and error and hypothesis and revision.
Patrick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Dalton Conley. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I applaud the author for his bravery to put himself out there like that. I guess my question is, what do you do in these situations with your child does this? How do you talk it through? And what if there's no good resolution? I'm guessing a lot of times there is no good resolution. And then also, what do you do with the siblings who are fighting? Do you have suggestions around that?
Well, I should, you know, we're talking about Chapter 7, but I think really important to put in context is an earlier chapter where I wanted to get them to do more math, to do math, to be better at math in school, because I think math is so important. It's a weeder subject for a lot of schools and a lot of academic life today. And, of course, it's of increasing importance in the economy writ large now. So I wanted to train them to do math. So I started bribing them to do math. This is another issue of, you know, a hotly debated issue of whether or not you should bribe your kids. One concern about bribery is that if you start paying people, kids or adults, to do some task, then any intrinsic motivation they had to do the task gets eroded from that being associated with the extrinsic reward. And, you know, I kind of waved away those concerns and started bribing my kids to do extra math during summer and during vacations and so forth with money or gummy bears or video game time or what have you.
At what age?
This is really around probably 8 starting. It's over now. They have enough homework as it is without extra math. So it turns out I don't think I eroded their innate desire to do math. I don't know how much there was to begin with anyway. But what I did do, and what the unintended perverse consequence of that was set up a market economy in my house. So now everything, if I need to get my son to do something, it's all a negotiation around a market price to do something extra. And also, discipline now takes the form of fines. So he has a base allowance, and it gets adjusted up or down based on things. And that's basically
– How old is he now?
He's now 14.
Do you regret instituting this market system in your home?
You know, I think he would have instituted it. he would have suggested it if I didn't institute it to
really?
Begin with. Who knows? You know, you can't run another – you know, brood of kids to try another experiment.
And since we're talking about the different siblings, relevant to your book, your previous book, The Pecking Order, you state in this chapter that you are suspicious of birth order as an explanation for anything. But you acknowledge right there in print that you're tougher on your firstborn daughter, the goody two-shoes, even though your son is the more prone to acting out. Can you unpack that a little?
Yeah. In my earlier book, I found that in families with two kids – there was no effect ultimately on their economic or educational success of whether or not they were first or second born. There might have been different pathways, different personalities to get to that ultimate socioeconomic status or educational attainment, but ultimately there was no cost of being first or second born. In larger families, I did document a cost to being the middle born, second or middle born in a larger family. So in my own kids, I was confronted with something that was, you know, ethnographic or prima facie evidence that I was wrong in the earlier book. There's got to be birth order effects because I can see my kids are so different. They so fit the birth order pattern of the hyper-responsible, adult-oriented firstborn and the rebellious secondborn that it really was a challenge to me as a social scientist.
Nicola in Brooklyn Heights. You're on WNYC with Dalton Conley. Hi.
Hi. So I've got a soon-to-be 16-year-old in a few days, and she's quite outspoken with me. And yet, when she's outside and around her friends, she's the sweetest thing. And I'm just wondering, I mean, should I punish her for talking crazy to me, or is that a phase that she's going through? Because I was raised in a Caribbean home where it was a dictatorship. It wasn't a democracy in my home. That I'm doing with her. So I'm wondering, should I go back to the democracy or should I let her express her crazy comments to me?
I mean, you're doing what I've advocated in the book or what I tried in the book, which is as long as she's polite to everybody out in the world, then give her a little space to vent at home. Now, you know, both of our kids, your daughter's the same age as my daughter. They're still works in progress. So who knows how this is all going to turn out? It could completely backfire in the end when they're adults. But I think that, you know, the literature suggests that adolescents do need some space to distance themselves from their parents, that they You know, they're going to do that one way or the other. If they do that in front of you by talking back or disagreeing with you, maybe that's more benign or even helpful than if they have to do it behind your back outside with their friends.
Okay.
Good luck, Nicola.
Thank you.
And does it drive you crazy being a sociologist of the thing that you're doing in your personal life? Do you find sometimes that you have too much information or too much conflicting information, since we know social science so often leads us in directions that have a lot of uncertainties?
Well, they often say that the kids of psychiatrists are the most screwed up. I think sociologists might have them beat by a peg. It's so anxiety-inducing to be in the field where you see – I go to talks, and instead of paying attention to whether or not the statistical models are right or I agree with the assumptions of the theory or whatever, I'm thinking, oh, my God, what does this mean for my kids? Oh, my God, they're finished. They're doomed. And it really can be a disadvantage, at least in terms of the parents' own calmness and well-being, to know too much about the research literature. The book tries to sort of, you know, make light of that and show me as a neurotic parent that's trying to sort all this out, this too much information. I mean, even what month you're born in, I've seen studies that published in the Proceedings of National Academy of Science, has an important impact on your health and longevity.
Wait, you mean horoscopes are real?
I guess so.
The book is Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children But Were Too Exhausted to Ask, by NYU sociologist Dalton Conley. And Nick in Oyster Bay, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nick.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Initially, I was a little disturbed by hearing about the giving the kid the green light to curse. For me, my perception of is it a lack of vocabulary? I perceive cursing as an act of violence. So in our family, what we try to instill with our kids is that it's okay to be angry. When they were younger, they didn't have the ability to express themselves, so we would all say, you got to put it into words. I started working for a company a while back, and so many people cursed there. And it took a long time to get them to stop cursing. I will say the same thing, listen, you're capable of so much more. And they eventually
you
did.
Say
no
that,
really
you, say, you say that to your coworkers?
Yes, I do, because I find it personally offensive. I perceive cursing as an act of violence. And so I would just, by all means, I don't want to be around this. I feel that people are capable of so much more. So to give a child the green light to go do that, we're obviously on different planets, because I would not do that. I wouldn't do it to another person.
Do you have kids? Do you have kids at home?
Yes, I do. I have twins, and I also have an older boy, my wife and I.
Of what ages, may I ask?
Our son is 10, and our twins are 7.
So do you get your son to say, Father, I am so frustrated and angry about external conditions in my life that sometimes I just want to express inappropriately the inner feelings that I'm experiencing at this moment. I'm joking, but how do you get
–
what do you tell him is acceptable, and can he do it?
Well, like in the moment, it won't be my wife or I that will irritate him. It will be one of his siblings, and we'll say, Pierce, it's okay to be angry, but you can't lash out physically. And you can't say certain words, because that's not something – do you want that said to you? And that's all we do. We mirror it back to him. Would you want this word said to you? And it's not a cursive, because, you know, I have a friend from Brazil, Brian, and he always says the same thing. You never see an orange fall from an apple tree. And it's really just the kids are merely a reflection of the parents. Their DNA in some way predisposes them to be that way.
Nick, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much.
I agree that there's a couple issues in here. One is usage of words. I agree 100% that using the F word or other curses is a shortcut, and it's vocabulary reducing, and it oversimplifies complex feelings. And I do emphasize that with my kids, that I want them to express exactly what they're feeling rather than just relying on those. On the other hand, in terms of the issue of it being violent, so to speak. I mean, there's definitely a clear line between physical violence and, if you want to call this emotional violence, cursing. However, I do notice that often using the curses, I tried to explain this to my kids, reduces how hurtful something can be. My daughter, who's never, as I said, never said a cuss word, she is so much more subtle. And the knife goes in much deeper when she says something, an offhand remark that she wants to I know she's actually angry and wants to hurt me or her brother. Maybe she has more practice at it because she's never said a curse word. But I don't think that necessarily curse words are more damaging or hurtful than something that's expressed as eloquently as Brian just expressed his frustration.
In the academic abstract, of course. The other detail from the chapter I wanted to bring out, and we're almost out of time, but we'll just mention it, your passage about taking your kids to adult movies like Truffaut's 400 Blows, to a violent Israeli anti-war movie called Waltzing with Bashir, to the Werner Herzog documentary Grizzly Man, which, let's just say, ends better for the grizzly than for the man. How do you decide?
Well, again, I didn't really decide. It kind of evolved. However, I would say that we're very concerned about, quote-unquote, protecting our children from age, quote-unquote, inappropriate material. However, I would say modern society is so age-segregated compared to past epochs that kids don't experience death, don't experience a sexuality, don't experience all the things we're trying to protect them in a mature adult way. And so then they're left online by themselves, perhaps, and they're being exposed to it. Even if you are the most controlling parent, you think you're protecting them from it. So why not actually engage things like the fact that sometimes people who invade bears' habitats get eaten, or that there is this horrible conflict going on in the Middle East?
And even regarding Grizzly Man, you note the different reactions between your super empathic daughter and your more devil-may-care son. You write that he laughed about what an idiot the ursine-eaten guy was, and your daughter said we should be more upset for the multiple bears that got shot in the film than we should for a guy who gets eaten. He was probably threatening their habitat, she rationalized, and grizzlies need to eat to survive too. Wow. This says here on my screen, Waleed in Dubai. Are you in Dubai or are you from Dubai, Waleed?
No, I'm from New York, but I'm in Dubai. Dawn's a close friend, so I couldn't miss up an opportunity to call.
Uh-huh. Okay, you guys could have gone to lunch, but instead you're having the public conversation on the radio instead of some other caller. I'm just giving you a hard time. What do you want to say?
So I'd love to hear Dawn talk a little bit about the science behind this. How do you go about studying something as complicated as parental techniques and look at outcomes with any reliability?
Well, that's a good question. Well, there is no way to study, for example, on your own kids. So I just throw out a bunch of things I do and kind of like spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks and what doesn't. In terms of actual social science, we don't randomly assign kids to parents. We do have some parenting interventions that try to train parents to do different things. They've yielded modest results. The best approach, I think, to studying these phenomena are, for example, to look at natural experiments. So the last chapter deals with the parental divorce that my kids experience. And if you want to really know whether or not
– You and your wife are divorced?
Yeah. To know whether or not divorce is it's easy to look at divorced parents and look at families that have two married parents still there and say, oh, look, the kids from divorced families end up worse than the kids from married families. But that's the apples and oranges comparison, because the real comparison is not between all married families and all divorced families. It's from between the divorced families and what would have happened if equally bad marriages stayed together. And that's a counterfactual you can't really observe. So social scientists will do things like MIT economist Jonathan Gruber did, which is look at state laws that make it easier or harder to be divorced that are independent of the condition of your marriage, and use that to see how kids turn out differently when we make it easier or harder based on public policy to get divorced. And, for example, he finds there are some costs of divorce.
But can you come to a sociologist answer? Can you approach the answer to the question, is it better for the children for parents in equivalently bad marriages to stay together or to get divorced?
I guess I would say, based on that study, and that's one study, but I would say it's the best one around, that there is a cost to kids of splitting up.
How do they feel, before you go, last question, how do your kids feel about their home life being revealed in print for all the world to see and presumably comment on tomorrow after this book has been out for a day on their Facebook pages?
Yeah, I think that they have grown up pretty used to being lab rats. I mean, their mother has been called a mad scientist in the press and involves them in her techno art, conceptual experiments and so forth. And, you know, I've always dipped into the personal, at least not as deeply as in this book, but in other books, to kind of frame sociological arguments. So I think they're pretty used to it by now, although this is going to be quite the test.
Dalton Conley, NYU sociology professor and chair of the Children and Parents section of the American Sociological Association, is the author now of Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children, But Were Too Exhausted to Ask. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now, an intro in which I trot out every tired caffeine cliche in the world by way of introducing Murray Carpenter, author of the new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. So perk up, everybody. We're about to brew a conversation with Murray that will leave you buzzing. He's no average cup of joe because he's been a longtime journalist and did tons and tons of research for this new book, looking at both the cultural and physiological impact of caffeine. It's out of my system. No more of that. But the point is, it's amazing how little we know about caffeine, something that is so common in our everyday lives. But Murray Carpenter is here to help break it down and answer your questions. Hi, Murray. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
And first, we should say that you're an unabashed caffeine addict. You are out about that in your book. What's your daily intake?
Well, I have to be careful about this because it's 3 to 4 cups of coffee. But, you know, everybody thinks of a cup of coffee differently. Some people, 3 or 4 cups of coffee would be 3 of those 16-ounce cups from Starbucks. But I'm about 3 to 4 6-ounce cups of coffee, so approximately 24 ounces of coffee a day.
I guess that's a lot of coffee by most standards, right? A lot of caffeine, I should say, by most standards.
It's a lot of caffeine. It actually puts me right about in the average of most American coffee drinkers.
Uh-huh.
So most American coffee drinkers take about 300 to 400 milligrams of caffeine daily via coffee, and that happens to be about where I stand.
Listeners, anything you always wanted to know about caffeine but had no one to ask, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or your coffee conundrums, because we're going to structure much of this conversation around a series of coffee conundrums inspired by Murray Carpenter's book, Caffeinated, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Murray, because I mentioned that we know less about caffeine than we tend to think, let's structure this interview around a number of what we're calling caffeine conundrums. So conundrum number one, it has all the effects of a drug, but we don't necessarily think of it as a drug. Would you call caffeine a drug?
Yes, it absolutely is a drug, but this is a terrific conundrum because the fact that most of us take it every single day, and most of us really we're dependent on this drug. It makes it an awkward conversation, really, to think of it as a drug. But yeah, absolutely, caffeine is a drug. Which is to say, you take caffeine, it has predictable physiological effects. You know, it increases your alertness, decreases your tiredness, it increases your vigor, even raises your mood. And these are effects that caffeine will have consistently in most people. So, yeah, it's been known for more than 100 years that caffeine is a drug.
So caffeine conundrum number two, it's a huge part of a lot of people's everyday lives, but many of us treat it very casually. And you sort of point out that there isn't really anything else that we do every day that has this sort of effect that we still think of so casually. People who drink 3-4 cups a day for 20 years still don't think of themselves as being drug addicts or having a serious relationship with a substance, right?
Yeah, and right. This is really fascinating. And in one way, it speaks to the fact that caffeine is a remarkably safe habit when used moderately. So most of us can take caffeine, 3 or 4 cups of coffee, for example, a day and not experience any bad side effects. But there are some people who really for whom caffeine is not a great drug. People who will experience insomnia and anxiety. Those are kind of the biggest side effects. But yeah, I think the fact that it's relatively sort of mild stimulant in, as we usually take it, and relatively safe, I think it allows us to view it rather casually.
I think Lisa in Wantage has a caffeine conundrum. Hi, Lisa. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's interesting because this question just came up in my home last week. My 15-year-old son is doing a research paper on headaches, in particular migraine headaches, and he learned all over research it says that caffeine can cause headaches. He and I both suffer from migraine headaches, and we both find that the caffeine actually takes away our headaches.
And wow, you, great question.
And I noticed that line in your book where you point out that a lot of people coming out of surgery suffer headaches, post-operative headaches. And there's a theory that a lot of this is because of caffeine withdrawal. People who've gone off their coffee regimens because they were going in for an operation.
It's fascinating. So this is sort of two ends of the caffeine headache spectrum. Caffeine has a very complex relationship with headache. So for some people, it can trigger headaches. And even in some people who suffer from migraines, caffeine can trigger headaches. But it can also be a very, very effective treatment for migraine headaches. In fact, caffeine can be such an effective treatment for people who suffer migraines that there are caffeine suppositories for people who are suffering migraines who are so severely afflicted that they're too nauseated to take a pill. So it can do that. But then additionally, one of the primary symptoms of caffeine withdrawal for anyone who uses caffeine regularly, daily, and goes without for a day or two is a headache.
Are either of these things because they tend to open the blood vessels in your brain or to your brain? Is that the right way to put it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I the relationship is complex. One of the things that caffeine does in your brain is it actually constricts some of the blood vessels in your brain. And the theory on some of the withdrawal headaches is that it's actually those blood vessels relaxing and the blood kind of pounding into those blood vessels that's creating that withdrawal headache.
Lisa, did you say you're 15-year-old? Drinks a lot of coffee along with you?
He doesn't drink. Actually, so we're two ends of the spectrum. So I drink just about one cup, sometimes two, of pretty strong espresso in the morning, and that's it. Unless I get a migraine, then I drink another cup of very strong espresso, and that does seem to help sometimes. My son never drinks caffeine at all unless he gets a headache. And when I do give him a cup of coffee at that point, it really seems to help.
Well, I'm curious, have either of you tried Anacin or Excedrin or any of the other over-the-counter headache formulas that use caffeine?
Yeah, I have, and Excedrin in particular, and it didn't really seem to do much of anything for me.
Because those have caffeine in them? Is that what you're getting at, Larry?
Yes, and the combination of aspirin, acetaminophen, and caffeine seems to be a remarkably effective treatment for headaches. And yeah, Anacin and Excedrin have long had caffeine,
Lisa,
as a component of
the drug. Lisa, thank you for your call. What else has caffeine in it that we don't usually think about?
Well, now there's, of course, this huge variety of energy products that have caffeine. I think most of us know that, but I have been surprised to see the sort of variety and abundance of these caffeine products. I got a sprayable caffeine, spray on the skin caffeine product last week. There's caffeinated gel strips, caffeinated energy bars, caffeinated gum, you name it.
Spray on caffeine?
Spray on caffeine. Yeah, I haven't tried this one yet. Yeah, you spray it on your skin.
And it absorbs through the skin and gives you a jolt?
That's the concept. It sounds rather weak. The instructions suggest if you don't see any effect, then you should quit caffeine for a week and try again.
Thinking about Lisa and her son, caffeine conundrum number three, kids sometimes report loving it, but parents freak out at the idea of children having caffeine. And yet I've heard some people say that some caffeine is okay for a kid and can help increase brain function. Is there good research that you've looked at?
There's not as much good research on adolescents and children and caffeine as there is on adults. And part of this is that it's more ethically difficult to do some of this. But kids do take a lot of caffeine, primarily through soft drinks, though increasingly the percentage that kids take through soft drinks is decreasing as soft drinks popularity decreases slightly, and coffee has been increasing. But children, I think 12 to 16-year-olds, take about an average of 63 milligrams of caffeine a day, which is no small amount, because caffeine, if you're a smaller person, you get a larger effect from a smaller amount of caffeine, obviously. So anyone who has a child who's taking caffeine late at night and experiences sleep problems, of course, it would be worth considering, you know, if they'd sleep better if they took less caffeine.
Jeff in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with Murray Carpenter, author of the book Caffeinated. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to ask Mr. Carpenter about the difference between coffee and tea, how much caffeine is in each, or if it's the body deals with the caffeine from either of those differently.
Mm-hmm. Coffee, tea, soda, same number of ounces, different doses of caffeine, Murray?
Yeah, absolutely. So tea tends to be a lot. There's just lower concentration of caffeine in tea than in coffee. And some people have also suggested that some of the other constituents of tea may sort of moderate the caffeine buzz from tea.
Although it depends on the kind of tea, right? Like certain kinds of green tea and black tea, pow.
Yeah, and it also depends on how long you soak it. So, you know, a 3-minute soak will maybe of black tea might have 30 milligrams of caffeine. 5-minute soak might have 50 milligrams. So you can get a fair amount of caffeine from tea, but typically, you know, considerably less than from a moderate cup of coffee. But, you know, a lot of people, for example, drink coffee in the morning and then tea in the afternoon when they want sort of a more moderate jolt.
David in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love coffee. I've been living on it for 30 years. I drink it continuously from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep. And I find that sometimes it relaxes me, that it has the opposite effect, that it doesn't give me the jitters at all. I also
Different days, David?
I'm sorry?
Different on different days, you're saying?
No, it just doesn't give me the jitters at all. It actually relaxes me. And
I'm going to leave it there and ask you, I guess I'll frame that as caffeine conundrum number 4, Murray, because it works on almost everyone in some way. But as we hear from David, it can really vary. For instance, we did a little survey of our team, and there are some people on our staff who cannot drink any caffeine after 10 o'clock in the morning, or they won't be able to fall asleep that night. And then there's someone on our show who has to drink a cup of coffee around 7 p.m. or else will fall asleep at 9. So how is it possible that there's such a big range?
Okay, but the caller raises this great question, and I want to get to the range question you talk about. But the first thing is, if you're a habitual caffeine user and you do drink it from the moment you get up to the moment you go to sleep, as the caller does, then you have a tolerance and something of a dependence on caffeine, and hitting that optimal caffeine dose will make you feel better than being caffeine free. I mean, so that accounts, I think, for some of his relaxation. When he has several cups of coffee, he's sort of in his sweet spot right there. But the second question, just in terms of how it affects people differently, this is remarkable, because as your survey showed, there are some people who will have a cup of decaf and it will really send them through the roof. And that's a tiny amount of caffeine, you know, 12 milligrams. And others of us who could drink coffee to the moment we go to sleep and sleep like babies. A lot of this tends to be a genetic predisposition. Some people are just genetically predisposed to metabolize caffeine much more slowly than the rest of us. And it is remarkable at what low levels some of these people are able to detect the presence of caffeine.
All right. Big office debate. Caffeine conundrum number 5. Is it possible to say, on aggregate, whether a cup of coffee hydrates you compared to before you drank the coffee, or dehydrates you?
Boy, I wish you hadn't asked that question. All the recent research suggests that it doesn't dehydrate you, but I just have it's almost impossible to convince people of this, because everyone has the experience that it seems to dehydrate you. It seems to make you want to go pee. It just does not seem to dehydrate you. That's my impression.
And the way one recent guest put it on our show is caffeinated drinks will dehydrate you. No, let me say it right. Won't hydrate you as much as non-caffeinated drinks because the caffeine has a slightly dehydrating effect, but you're still taking in fluid that you wouldn't have taken in. So the net effect is still plus, just not as plus.
That sounds about right to me, yeah.
And we leave it there with Murray Carpenter, author of the book Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Listeners, continue to post your caffeine conundrums to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Murray Carpenter, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.